Paul's mom watched her leave with a raised eyebrow. She pronounced the word Filipino weird, slowly, making sure that every syllable hit her shriveled tongue as the word slid out of her mouth. I tried to ignore her. Everyone loved my desserts. And everyone squealed with glee when Paul showed up, unexpectedly, with roses, which my mom graciously accepted and put into the vase that was waiting to receive them. It had been Mauve's idea, and my mom didn't argue, even though she hates flowers. When everyone else left, Paul's mom started talking.
"Well, that was a lovely turnout. We didn't have quite so many contraptions for our children when Polly was growing up."
My mom murmured her agreement and only cringed a little when she heard her call him Polly. She thinks it's obnoxious when grown men still sport their cutesy baby names.
"You know,"
Paul's mom said in that annoying whiny voice she adopts whenever she's about to make a point,
"it's really time you start talking about living arrangements for when the baby comes."
My mom and Paul were both trying to figure out how to set up the baby swing they'd just gotten, and it looked like they didn't really process what she was saying.
"You can't just pretend you don't hear me."
"No one is pretending that, Mother. We're just waiting for you to make your point," Paul said.
"Where is he going to live when the baby is born?"
She looked directly at me when she said it, and I swear I heard my mom hiss. That did it. It might have been a pleasant, laughter-filled afternoon before that moment, but that was all over now.
"I sincerely hope you're not talking about my son."
My mom is nice. Mostly. But she can get scary real quick.
"No, of course she's not," said Paul.
He glared at his mother, who did not flinch.
"Like hell I'm not," she said, "if you're going to endanger the life of my grandchild."
And from there it got pretty heated. Like, really heated. I didn't even have time to get angry about her accusation, because my mom immediately came unglued and my unborn brother or sister was treated to some surprisingly salty language. I was a little proud. Paul had to remove his mother from our house before my mom killed her. I sat at the kitchen table with Mom for a while without saying anything. She squeezed my hand. I squeezed back, but we were silent. I think she thought that if she tried to speak, she'd cry. Paul came back home, and my mom went directly to their bedroom to lie down without saying a word, slamming the door behind her. Paul sighed and grabbed a beer, and I asked him something I knew he was probably thinking about. "Are you worried that your kid might turn out like me?"
"Like you?"
"No." "Are you sure?"
"Yours is not the influence I worry about. I think it's safe to say that on her most normal day, my mother could out-crazy you."
It was the wrong thing to say, and I think he knew that when the words left his mouth. But we both laughed anyway, grateful that my mom wasn't there to ruin the moment by being offended. But somewhere in the back of my head, all I could think was, challenge accepted. Chapter 35.
Dosage 3 milligrams. Reducing dosage to discontinue.
May 8, 2013. I feel fine. One of the many reprieves from our actual education is the annual visit from the Knights of Columbus. Maya says they visit all the Catholic schools in the state, and they've been coming to St. Agatha's since she was little. There were 3 old men with papery skin and knobby knees from the local chapter standing together with their little navy blue suits and lapel pins. As a Columbian squire, Dwight had to stand at the front of the room with them, wearing his own navy blue blazer and lapel pin. He looked mortified. Ian was standing next to him, along with a few other boys, but Ian didn't look embarrassed. He just looked bored. It's hard to waste too much energy disliking these old guys, though. They do a lot of charity work and put a lot of money back into local businesses. They're also mostly harmless old men who are just in a club because it was something their fathers wanted them to do, and they're too ancient to cause trouble.
And yet there's something. Definitely a creep factor.
I remember their signs outside our grocery store. I remember the way my mom shook her head and pushed me toward the car before one of the knights could offer us a button. There was something my mom didn't like about them. I think it's the way they protect family values, but only families that look like theirs. I think it's also the way they like to quote Leviticus. The oldest and frailest of the group opened his mouth to speak. For a second, I was sure that nothing but dust was going to trickle out. But he was feisty for an old guy.
"We're here today,"
he said in a voice that sounded like every FDR recording I've ever heard, "to talk to you about becoming Colombian squires, or squirettes, as the case may be." He grinned at the girl in the front row, then proceeded to tell us about the history of the organization and the essay contest they sponsor every year. "Here's my problem. I feel guilty about thinking bad things about old people no matter how much I don't like them. It's like I'm programmed to respect old age as a virtue all on its own, with the exception of Paul's evil mother. Respect your elders. When shouldn't it be respect everyone? But the thing I forget when I look into their sad, pathetic, cataract-filled eyes is that being old does not make you a good person. Old age is not, in itself, an admirable quality. Sometimes it just means you haven't had the sense to let anything kill you." My mind might have already started to wander at this point. Rebecca sat straight up and reached for my hand. She always knew when something was going to happen before it did. A second later, two men walked through the door, and I understood her anxiety. I've only seen them a handful of times. In fact, I'd nearly forgotten what they looked like. These two hardly ever show up when I'm alone, and they never do anything quietly. In fact, they kicked the door open so hard that it crashed against the opposite wall, knocking imaginary items off the shelves. And not to sound too philosophical, but I know why these hallucinations come around. They come around when I want to argue, but can't. They're both tall, older gentlemen in three-piece suits. One is thin and the other is fat. And they're both British because, I guess, if my subconscious is going to win an argument, it's going to be with an English accent. The thin man is called Rupert, and the fat one is Basil. Their names popped into my head the same way they did, quickly and without explanation.
"Right," said Rupert, leaping onto Sister Catherine's desk and kicking papers to the floor. "I can't believe they do this in a school. They should actually be learning something, yeah? Something useful?"
"You'd think so," said Basil, stuffing a muffin into his mouth. "But these gentlemen look like they're half dead already. What a shame."
"God, it must be bloody awful to be that old. Imagine sitting on your shriveled manberries."
Basil spat out his muffin.
"Oi, Rue, enough. That's disgusting," said Basil.
"Just listen to them," Rupert said, his lips curling into a smile. "Knights of Columbus. I don't think I've ever heard anything more ridiculous. Do they even know who Columbus was? Not exactly a role model. And the subject of the essay is the real message of the Catholic Church."
He laughed, rolling off the desk and onto the floor.
"What do you think they should write about?"
"How to not get caught raping little boys," Basil offered.
"Or how to quietly sack a pope for his secret ring of pedo priests,"
Rupert shouted, swinging from the overhead lights while Basil fished a bag of candy out of his pocket.
"Yoo-hoo! Adam!" Rupert called in a high, girlish voice.
"Thoughts? We wouldn't be here if you didn't have any. In fact, you probably agree with us."
This was always the worst part. The persistent hallucinations who want a reaction. Of course, you'd say that I was the one who wanted a reaction since the visions belonged to me. But they wouldn't leave me alone. They juggled, took swigs of something from a flask and sang, "Danny Boy."
I hate that song. Rupert even dropped his pants and shook his bare ass in Sister Catherine's face. The old man up front never stopped talking. Phrases like, "Your duty as young Catholics," and "defending your faith against immorality," floated across the room. His cracked and wrinkled lips continued to flap up and down while I watched the two British gentlemen destroy the classroom without turning my head. The trick was pretending to pay attention to the old guys at the front instead. The problem with that is Rupert and Basil are not to be ignored.
"You were a lot more fun when you thought we were real," said Basil, shaking his head sadly at me.
"Is that her?"
Rupert whistled. He walked over to Maya's desk.
"The one you..."
"You know?"
He wriggled his finger into a hole he'd made with his index finger and thumb. Both of them laughed.
"And your first time you were dressed as Jesus. I applaud you, sir." "A lovely creature, to be sure," said Basil, his belly drooping over his belt.
That was when I stood up and left the classroom, taking the bathroom pass with me. Everyone's head turned in my direction as I walked straight for the door. Maya's eyes burned into the back of my head, and I saw Ian turn toward me with interest. The old man faltered a little in his speech, but picked it back up pretty quickly. Sister Catherine didn't try to stop me, but her blonde eyebrows disappeared into her forehead in disapproval.
"She needs a good shag," Basil whispered, shaking his head.
I walked straight to the bathroom and splashed water on my face. Naturally, they followed me. It was too much to ask that they would give me some privacy and let me clear my head. Rebecca leaned against the bathroom wall and glared at them.
"It's no good looking at us like that," said Rupert, sticking his tongue out at her. "Adam is verbally constipated at this school. You know it. I know it. Basil knows."
He turned around to look for him.
"Really? Right now?"
Basil was using the urinal closest to the door.
"Had to take a leak," Basil groaned. "Don't you get tired of keeping quiet?" Rupert asked me.
"No," I whispered.
"Oh, he speaks," Basil said. "About time."
"Please go away," I said.
"Why? So you can lie to yourself?"
"Please," I asked again. I held onto the sides of the sink, trying to steady myself. The headaches rolled like waves against my temple. For a second, I thought I had it under control, but then I felt the acid rise in my throat as I turned and vomited all over the urinal. Rebecca leaped from where she'd been standing to put her hand on my back.
Rupert rolled his eyes.
"Look," Rupert said, running his fingers through his hair. "You're too big to act like a timid mouse, my friend. You've got big ideas and your opinions are valid. I don't think you've said a word in class since you got here," said Basil, pulling out his candy again.
I hoped he'd washed his hands.
"Please," I begged. "I can't do this here. I shouldn't be seeing you."
The room started to spin again, and I knew that I was losing control. I could feel the throbbing in my temple and the rise of the vomit in my throat again. Rupert looked hurt.
"You're losing it," he said. "You'd rather keep quiet and take your drugs until there's nothing real left in you. Until everything that's beautiful and creative and interesting about you is diluted. You're pathetic." "Get out!" I screamed.
It was bad timing. Some third grader had wandered into the bathroom at the exact moment that I'd screamed. It might have been startling to walk into someone shouting in a bathroom, but I imagine my size coupled with the fact that my fists came crashing down against the sink just as he walked in made it even more terrifying. For a second, he looked like he wanted to cry. Then he bolted. The door didn't even get the chance to slam shut behind him before I saw Ian staring at me blankly, then fumbling hurriedly with something in his pocket as he turned toward the puddle of puke on the urinal. He didn't say a word. He didn't even look smug. I was shaking, and his eyes were just opened wide in disgust. Maybe even fear. Rebecca reached for my hand, and we walked out of the bathroom in silence, slamming into Ian's shoulder as we left. We didn't stop walking until we got home. It's funny how sometimes your own hallucinations can hurt you without touching you or saying anything you didn't already know. When I walked out into the hall, I could still see them both out of the corner of my eye, their suits like blurs in my vision. "Coward," they whispered. Chapter 36.
Dosage 2.5 milligrams. Tapering off. Monitoring Adam for a negative reaction to decrease in drug.
May 15, 2013. Sometimes when you talk, I don't actually process what you've said until I get home. Like last week, when you asked about the prom coming up and told me how nervous you were about your first high school formal, I sort of tuned you out because I haven't had time to worry about stuff like that. Don't feel bad. I tuned Dwight out too when he said he was going to ask Claire. I mean, I think I nodded or something, but I didn't actually offer anything insightful to the conversation. I might have told him that I'd see him there. I pretended to listen to Maya talk about her dress. I think it was at that point that she told me it was going to be blue and strapless. It was the girliest conversation I'd ever had with her. But instead of appreciating it for the Loch Ness Monster moment that it was, I'd ignored her, too. I nodded, kept up with the conversation, and let her believe that I was having one of my headaches when, for the first time in months, I actually wasn't. My head felt fine. Maya never said those things that girls usually do when they think something is wrong. The barrage of questions or the inane, "Are you mad at me?" Those kinds of things would never have occurred to her because, one, a barrage of questions is more annoying to her than it is to me, and, two, she knew she'd done nothing wrong. When I got home, I opened my blinds for the first time in months and threw open my window. My mom says keeping the blinds closed was something I've done since I was a toddler. From the time I could reach the cord, I'd pulled them closed. I sat in my desk chair and watched the people outside for a long time. In the evenings, our street is packed with people. Kids, mostly. But a lot of joggers and old ladies walking their dogs, too. It's noisy. I'd forgotten how noisy it was. The sound of feet on asphalt is irritating, and the crunch of bicycle wheels over gravel feels like nails on a chalkboard. But then I remembered that I didn't open my window to listen. I wanted to take a real look outside. It took a few seconds to get there, but I knew it was waiting for me. Next to the trees along the sidewalk, I could see it more clearly. The blades of tall grass outside my house began to move as if tiny creatures were creeping in it. I could always find the edges of crazy if I looked hard enough. The sun was setting, and the street I'd always tried to hide from was changing. Street lamps flooded the concrete with orange light beneath the massive jacaranda trees that left purple crap all over the ground. Then suddenly there were no moving bodies to stare at, and the odd car that happened to glide past our driveway floated in slow motion, as if the people driving through knew there was something wrong with me. I tried to listen to them. "Why is he staring out the window like that? What is he looking at?"
I'm not paranoid.
Maya sent a few more messages about her dress, but I didn't respond, which isn't like me. I told her earlier that I'd wear whatever tux she wanted me to. I'd pick it up before this Saturday. But there was something different about tonight. I keep looking out at the neighborhood, waiting for something else to happen. Until finally it does. It's subtle. None of the familiar characters charge the streets, and the voices don't start. But the ground rolls beneath my toes. I can feel it breathe. Even the darkness is intensified. Everything is alive. The smell of star jasmine outside my window reminds me of Maya. She says it's her favorite scent in the world, and it actually does make me feel good for half a second before I remember what's going to happen to me. It wasn't a good meeting with my doctors today. They asked a lot of the same questions, though nobody seemed to care much about my sex drive. Unlike the other 65% of the schizos in the study, I'm not actually getting any better. Which they already know because my results indicated a weakened response to treatment. My body has started developing immunity. They issued the final stop date. They can't advise continued treatment because of prior complications with my heart. So I stared out the window and listened to my phone buzz with Maya's texts because I didn't want to respond. Rebecca reached out to touch my hand.
Is it strange watching your world crumble around you, knowing there's nothing you can do about it?
I imagine it's strange.
It was Rupert, leaning back on my bed with a lit cigarette, looking bored, while Basil snored against the wall on the floor, scratching his balls.
Leave him alone, said Jason.
Why? Said Rupert.
Look at him. He's already angry. He's got so much anger in him, it's trying to claw its way out.
He walked over and stared into my eyes, putting both hands on my shoulders.
He wants to scream and break things.
Well, you're not helping, Jason muttered.
We're not supposed to help, said the mob boss, suddenly appearing next to the window. We're not supposed to do anything. We're just here. Always here.
I know, I screamed. I can't fucking take this anymore. Just stop talking. All of you, please stop talking.
Then it was quiet, and it was just me and Rebecca listening to the voices sing while I sat down to answer Maya's texts. Chapter 37.
Dosage unknown.
May 22, 2013.
Bad things happened. Hospitals smell weird. Like piss and antiseptic. I should tell you that I'm not the guy you met anymore. You know this already, but I feel compelled to tell you anyway, just so you know I know. I'm not on the same drug anymore, so I'm feeling pretty tired. This other stuff they've put me on feels weird.
I wet the bed when I first got here. That's one of the cool side effects. You can't really feel it when you have to pee. I didn't realize you told my mom about our silent sessions, but I guess that makes sense. She doesn't really let anyone keep secrets from her. I'm sure that even if you wanted to keep that little bit of our relationship a secret, you couldn't have. My mom knows. That's why I'm sending this entry to you as an email instead of handing it to you across your desk. Gotta love my mom. Even when everything goes to shit, she wants me to keep seeing my therapist. It's her ongoing journey to make me whole. Probably because she feels responsible that I'm broken.
How's my boy?
She asked, like nothing had changed. She brought me my laptop and told me to do what I always do. I told her I normally just answer the questions you asked me during our last session together. She told me to just make questions up. I said something like, "Well, I've made up the rest of my life. Why should this be any different?" So she started to cry, and I started to cry too. And Rebecca, who had already been crying, was a hot mess.
"I don't know what you want me to write. Just tell him what happened. Didn't you already tell him that? Let him hear it from you.
He's never actually heard,
just write it, Adam."
It was the closest she's ever come to scolding me, and I could feel the wave of regret the minute she raised her voice, but eventually Paul came in and took her down the hall to get some tea. Herbal tea. She still doesn't want to have Earl Grey until after the baby is born. The caffeine, you know. Moms give up a lot of stuff for their kids. I ended up not having to make anything up after all.
Thanks for coming to visit me, by the way. I'm not exactly sure what they have me on now, but by the way you were reading my chart and shaking your head, it's really strong stuff. Which is why I've been so out of it. I'm still in awe of your ability to talk while I say nothing. You still haven't given up on me. The pause after your questions is so optimistic, so courteous, it almost makes me sad. But I gotta hand it to you. The dry erase boards were pretty crafty. When you handed me one and started writing with the other, I was actually a little bit impressed. I mean, you probably could have done this months ago and stumbled across some huge breakthrough, but better late than never, right? Writing to you while you were sitting right in front of me was weird. Your handwriting is terrible, by the way. Also, can you let me know if this didn't actually happen? Are you real?
Yep.
How can I be sure?
You can't.
Why are you here?
Just checking on you.
I'm not your responsibility right now, Doc.
I know.
But you feel guilty?
Not the right word.
Afraid?
No.
Disappointed?
No.
Then what?
Angry.
At me?
Of course not.
At who, then?
The universe.
I'm angry, too.
Do you want to talk about it?
No. When we both laughed, that was the first time I'd smiled since I got to the hospital. Thanks for that, Doc. But maybe it's time we came to terms with the fact that I am not getting any better. The miracle drug that changed my life was not as magical as we'd all hoped. You want to know what happened at prom, but you already know. You think I'd get annoyed telling you things you already know, but I'm Lucy in the sky with diamonds right now, so I'll tell you. I assume you just want me to tell you in my own words so you can close your file once and for all and mark me with the scarlet C for crazy. So here goes. I knew they were going to cut me off soon, so I saved up a bunch of Tozaprex before prom. I can go a day without feeling the effects of a missed dose, so I'd been skipping every other day for 2 weeks. I went into the back of the closet and pulled out all the doses I'd saved and took them all at once. Because, in my mind, that would get rid of all the side effects that have been cropping up. Mom and Paul had already decided that I couldn't go to prom. It was one of those for-your-own-good moments. Mom cried and told me that I needed to tell Maya, which is probably what I should have done. Instead, I told them I'd already explained it to Maya. But there was no way I could have disappointed her like that. I lied to everyone and went. I had Maya pick me up while my mom was taking a nap. She didn't ask why my mom wasn't begging us to take a million pictures inside the house, which is what she would have done normally. I guess she was distracted. We weren't exactly the epitome of cool rolling up to school in a green Odyssey. But Maya doesn't care about that stuff. She had no interest in getting a limo. Fancy crap that doesn't mean anything makes her uncomfortable, and the van was good enough. Dwight and Claire were meeting us there. Maya said we were all going to get dessert somewhere afterward. Let's pause here to address the fact that I hadn't noticed what she was wearing or even taken the time to make sure that my tie was straight. I was busy trying not to throw up. My amazingly perceptive girlfriend didn't notice because she had concerns of her own that night. You can't blame her. Dances take a lot more effort for girls than they do for guys. Her entire day had probably been spent getting ready. I was out the door in 20 minutes while my mom had been passed out on the couch. When we got out of the car, I walked over to put on her corsage, the one I'd hid in the back of the fridge so Mom and Paul wouldn't see. I was about to say something pointless about getting in line for pictures or putting the tickets in her purse when I stopped mid-sentence. A lot of women look good in formal dresses, so it isn't really fair to say that Maya was the most beautiful girl ever in existence. But that was basically the truth. She looked like an angel. I'll describe her for you in case you've never seen an angel, and because I'm really high,
and talking about angels is oddly comforting. Somehow she'd gotten her normally bone-straight hair to fall in soft curls around her face. Her dress was pale blue and didn't have any of that gaudy, sparkly crap. It was elegant and fell just off her shoulders. There was a band of shiny fabric under her breast that tied in a bow behind her. And at the right angle, it really did look like folded wings. And I clearly wasn't the only one who thought so. Plenty of people were turning their heads in our direction. Granted, some of them were probably muttering something about Maya needing to be saved from the giant ogre behind her. But mostly they were gasps of awe. Did the doctors tell you that this is the first time in 2 days that I haven't been strapped down and sedated? Anyway, I was okay with the fact that I'd lied to get there. I didn't know how long it would be until my mom woke up or Paul got home and realized I was gone. But I knew they wouldn't embarrass me when they got there. They'd just show up, wait in the back of the gym, and throw daggers at me with their eyes. That would be the worst of their wrath. I just didn't realize that it was my reaction I needed to worry about. Maya pretended that she didn't care about dances and dresses and girly stuff, but she had a death grip on my hand. She was happy. Can that be where the story ends? I feel like since these are my entries and I clearly have problems, that this should be the point when the story ends because we were both happy and everything was fine, even though it actually wasn't. If I'm good enough, do you think we could make it so that everything that happened after that moment was a hallucination? Maybe we could all pretend that prom hadn't happened yet, right? If everyone pretends together, that makes it real.
I can almost see your face.
The sad smile that you've adopted whenever you read something that clearly provides evidence to have me locked up forever. You should work on keeping your expression neutral. I would be happier if you didn't care at all. I'd like a lot more people to provide neutral expressions, actually. I think they would be closer to what they're actually feeling. No one can possibly care that much. I am crazy, but even I know that can't be where the story ends. I started feeling the effects of the drugs a few minutes after I took them. It had been too much all at once. Maya thought I was just nervous because I don't like crowds, but I was sweating and having a difficult time breathing. That was a warning. I should have already been heading to a hospital, but then a slow dance came on, and the part of me that wanted to be a normal guy pulled Maya onto the dance floor. We waved at Dwight and Claire, who were swaying awkwardly nearby. Catholic school dances are pretty tame. There were streamers and glow-in-the-dark stars hanging from the ceiling, and the DJ they'd hired had a strobe light flashing against the wall and monitors projecting neon images around the dance floor. Once in a while, a nun would push two kids apart and whisper something about leaving space between them for the Holy Spirit. Still, Maya leaned into me and I tried to forget that I wasn't normal. She almost made it happen. But they found me eventually. All of my imaginary friends were there. That feels nicer than calling them hallucinations, doesn't it? I could see them all lined up against the wall while I was dancing with Maya. They all wore somber expressions on their faces. And I realized that they were sad for me. None of them wanted to be what I was afraid of. They didn't even want to be there. It was the voices. I heard something break while I was dancing with Maya. A glass, maybe, but I couldn't see where it was. I jerked my head in the direction of the sound and must have accidentally tugged Maya along with me, because she asked me if I was okay. I'm fine. Come on, let's sit down. You're not fine, she said. No, I want to keep dancing. You have a headache. We should sit for a minute. I'm fine. I let her drag me to a table at the back of the auditorium, as a roar that sounded like crashing waves at the beach filled my ears and knocked the wind out of me. I fell into the closest chair. We're leaving. Something is wrong. You're sweating. I'm fine. Nothing is wrong. But even as I said this, I knew she would never believe me. It's one thing for her to not know exactly what was wrong with me, and another thing entirely for her to be oblivious to a problem. And my hands were already shaking when I noticed Ian standing at the other end of the dance floor, staring at us. Just then, the monitors that lined the dance floor stopped flashing, and an entirely different visual began playing on all 10 screens as the music stopped playing. It was a video of me. I was illuminated on the screens, vomiting onto a urinal, slamming my hands against the sink, screaming, "Get out!" at the third grader. My eyes unfocused and my hand shaking. Someone had recorded the whole thing. And suddenly I couldn't breathe.
"Adam?"
Maya whispered, trying to put her hand on my back.
"What's going on?"
Then the voices started. "What is he waiting for?" "He has to run. Everyone knows now. He's got to get out." Ian had done this. He'd always hinted that he knew my secret, but now he had evidence. And the rest of the school could see it too. There I was, a freak on display for everyone to see. For Maya to see. I saw Ian run toward us, and my body began to vibrate. I just knew I had to move, but before I could do anything, he turned into something else. Something dark and unnatural that slithered across the floor and launched itself into my chest. It's hard for me to give details about what happened next, so I'll tell you what my mom told me. Apparently, she'd heard it from Sister Catherine, who came to pray over me when I first got here. I was out of it, so I don't really remember. Hearing it from my mom was worse than remembering it myself. I had to keep asking for details until she told me the whole story. "You screamed for a long time before you would let anyone get near you," she said. I don't have any memory of this, so it's weird that I can still burn with shame, isn't it? Who was I screaming at?
I don't know.
But I could tell by the way she'd said it that she meant she knew I was screaming at nothing. "Did I hurt anyone?"
"No,"
she whispered, touching my face. "Liar," I said. She'd made her trademark lemon face.
"You pushed her down, sweetheart, but she's fine."
I remembered sticking out my arm to stop something from running into me. I shoved it away from me and ran in the opposite direction as fast as I could. I'd had no idea it was Maya. I lost control and pushed Maya to the ground. And while I was busy losing my mind, there was no one to tell her what was going on. No one to explain. "Does she know?" I asked. My mom nodded, wiping tears off my cheek. She held my hand for a long time.
"I told her, honey."
I cried for a long time, but I didn't get mad about it. I didn't tell my mom it wasn't her place to tell Maya anything. She'd given me plenty of opportunities to tell her myself, and I couldn't do it, so in the end, my mom did my dirty work. All I'd wanted was for her to keep telling me that Maya was okay and that I didn't hurt her. It seemed like every time she said it, it wasn't real and I needed to hear it again. She didn't say anything else about the prom, about taking the drugs when I wasn't supposed to, about lying to her and Paul and putting myself in danger. I told you that my mom is the kind of person who makes you feel important. And she is. But she's also the kind of person who makes you want to feel powerless because it's nice to be taken care of. After a while, she told me that the baby was kicking and asked me if I wanted to talk to her belly. I just shook my head and asked her where Paul was. He was waiting in the hall, giving us some privacy. It must be hard to hold someone's hand while they're in restraints. And on the list of shitty things you have to do as a parent, telling your kid what happened when he lost his mind is pretty high up there. My mom said that Maya had tried to visit when I was in the ICU, but it was against hospital rules. Family only. When they transferred me here, I still didn't want to see her. Actually, I just didn't want her to see me. But I did see her mom. Remember I told you she's a nurse? She came in to check my IVs, but didn't say a word while she worked. I didn't want to say anything to her, but I couldn't stop myself. She had Maya's eyes. "Can you tell her I'm sorry?" I whispered to her. "You can tell her yourself." "I can't see her again. Not like this." She looked at me. "Nothing you have is impeding your speech. You can tell her yourself." "Look," I said. "Now you know what I have. You understand better than she does. You know there is no cure. I'm going to be messed up for the rest of my life. Am I really the kind of boyfriend you want for her?" She considered me for a moment and then turned to leave with her tray of instruments. "That," she said, "is not up to me." Then she closed the door behind her, leaving me alone to fully appreciate how warm and fuzzy Maya was compared to her mom. Later, I could remember fragments of what had happened. Even in my delirious, drug-soaked mind, I remember the look on Maya's face when I pushed her. Funny how you can remember something small like that. The way her face sort of dropped when she fell. Her eyes were wide, and her hands were stretched out at either side of her body as she looked up at me from the ground. I must have looked like a monster. That was when I ran. I didn't get far, obviously. I'm surprised I even made it up to the bathroom between the church and the hall to throw up. The words were still scrawled on the bathroom wall in there, and it made me wonder if they couldn't get them cleaned off, or if the nuns left them there as a reminder. "Jesus loves you. Don't be a homo." That fit somehow. Together, it sounds like a conditional phrase. Separately, it sounds like one guy being nice and another guy being an asshole. But the most surprising thing about it was the way it could be twisted with one extra word. "Jesus loves you, but don't be a homo." It was all in how you read it. "Jesus loves you" basically says, "Come as you are." "Don't be a homo" passes judgment. They contradict each other like everything else in life, I guess. You'll hear one thing that gives you hope and another thing that takes it away. Be who you are, but not that. Anything but that. That was what I was thinking when I threw up again. But after that, I was definitely gone. There were footsteps. I remember that Rebecca held my hand in the ambulance, and I thought it was odd that I couldn't hear my mom. I heard Paul instead. Somewhere in the back of my mind, I knew he was crying. He kept saying that everything was going to be okay.
"I'll call your mom when we get to the hospital. You don't have anything to worry about. I'm here."
I let him take my hand because, really, what else was I going to do? He took the hand Rebecca was already holding. She looked at me for a moment, as if willing me to say something. The thing we both knew I wanted to ask. "You're not real, are you?" It's stupid. But when Rebecca shook her head, I felt heavy, like I was learning it for the first time.
"I'm real, Adam."
Of course, Paul was the one to answer. I didn't say anything else. I just let him squeeze my hand. I bet you think that all these months of therapy and experimental treatment have been a waste since I wound up crazier than before. If it makes you feel any better, you still got paid. And it was nice of you to visit me in the hospital. I said that already, didn't I? It's also nice that I can always tell that you're not a hallucination. Nothing in my imagination would conjure up that hair or those pants. Chapter 38. May 29, 2013. Coward. That was what I was thinking. Yes, Maya is still calling and sending texts and trying to visit, but I haven't responded and I told the nurses not to let her in. Not since the last time, when I woke up to find her sitting next to my bed. I was pretty high on whatever they'd given me, so for a minute I didn't know what to think. I figured it would be best to check.
Are you real? I asked.
Yes,
she said. I could tell she'd been crying. Her eyes were red and she was wringing her hands in her lap like she was trying to get blood pumping to her fingers. Then she looked at me again and I saw it. That tiny flicker of understanding that hadn't been there before prom. That little spark of knowledge that meant she knew now. And there was nothing I could do to take it back.
How long have you known there was something wrong with me? I asked.
We both knew there was no point in denying it. She wiped the corners of her eyes with her sleeve.
I didn't know what it was, she said. I just noticed the headaches. And sometimes you had this look like you were seeing things.
She looked up at me, and my throat burned. But no matter how much I wanted to, I was not going to cry in front of her. I wasn't.
Why didn't you tell me? She asked.
I didn't want you to know I'm broken. I was suddenly very aware of how I must look to her. My eyes had been bloodshot the day before. I wondered if they still were. My hair was matted to one side, and I could feel a sticky patch of sweat on the back of my neck.
But how could you keep this a secret from me? She asked.
I kept it a secret from everyone.
I thought...
She paused.
I thought I was different.
She searched my face for something. Sanity, understanding. I'm not sure what, but when she looked down again and started to cry, I knew she hadn't found it. I took a deep breath. No, I said. You're not different. You were always going to be afraid of me.
Adam, that isn't fair, I shouted.
Do you really think any of this is fair? Do you think fair has anything to do with what's wrong with me? She shook her head as the tears rolled down her cheeks. I'd scared her. I knew the minute I raised my voice. She flinched. And I realized I was the one who'd made her do that. I really was a monster.
Please, Adam, let's just talk about this when you're feeling better. You've been through a lot.
Feeling better, I muttered. Crazy isn't something you ever recover from, Maya.
Just let me help.
No, I shouted, again, deliberately. I've already let you do too much.
Please, Adam,
she said. And for the first time, she actually sounded as small as she looked.
Just go, I said. It's better if you just leave.
It didn't matter that I could suddenly hear all the voices talking at once, or that the bullets from the mobster's guns made me flinch in my bed. I pushed the button for the nurse, and Maya got up and walked out, still crying. That was when I realized that I hadn't actually been broken until then. Until I'd made her cry. I was actually relieved that my mom told Maya. It meant I didn't have to. I don't have to see her again if I don't want to. I can even pretend I never saw her. It doesn't matter in the long run. I'm not good for her anyway. It's sweet that your questions are still pretty stupid. You asked me to tell you what the voices are saying. That sounds like something my mom wants to know. And I'm not sure I can tell you because sometimes it's not even words. Sometimes it's just scratchy noises that turn into nothing. Sometimes the voices just sound angry, and I can't really translate the sound. Even Rebecca is different. I'll be in the hospital for a few more days, and she seems really anxious about it. She hides a lot when people walk into the room. I tell her no one can see her, but she just shakes her head. The good thing about this place is that I can sleep again. Glorious sleep. I'd forgotten how good it feels to just let yourself die for 10 hours. The only shitty part is waking up. Yeah, I am distraught about not going back to school. Horribly distraught. It tears me up inside that I don't have to sit through another sanctimonious little lecture about make-believe spirits and people who cut themselves for God. No, I'm not sad.
I'm not a weeping pile of shit. I don't feel sorry for myself, and I don't have any intention of telling you what I'm actually thinking right now because, one, I don't know what you're going to do with that information, and two, I don't want to. I'm back home, which you already know. Dwight showed up at my house on Monday wearing his tennis clothes, looking pale as usual. "Do you want to serve first?" he asked. I just stared at him. "Hello?" Dwight said. "Dude, I can't go out and play tennis today. Didn't your mom tell you everything?" I knew our moms had spoken already, but it was a weird moment. "No, I can't come outside to play. I'm crazy right now." "She did." "Then why are you here?" "It's Monday. We play tennis on Mondays." He put his backpack down on the floor and started pulling things out of it. "Okay, but you have no idea." "Actually, I do." "Then why are you here?" "It's Monday," he repeated, as if nothing had happened, and it was the most obvious answer in the world. "And I am a schizophrenic nutcase who has hallucinations and hears voices." "I know. My mom told me." He raised his eyebrows. "Dwight, I'm not going out to play tennis." "Good," he said. "That's why I brought this." He lifted a Wii console out of his backpack and started plugging it into our TV in the family room. "We'll play here." "I suck at video games, dude." "You also kind of suck at tennis. Do you want to serve first?" Before I could say anything else, he turned on the game and handed me a white controller. I stared at it for about 20 seconds before taking it from him. So we played tennis in my family room for a while. Jason sat behind us, his bare ass nestled into the couch cushions. Rebecca sat next to him. Both of them watched our game like it was the most amazing match they'd ever seen in their lives. Then we ate Oreos and Dwight packed up his stuff. We didn't say another word about me being crazy. It was almost like it didn't matter. I miss baking. All the knives and sharp objects have been removed and are hiding in some undisclosed location, like a witness protection program. Everything they think I might use to hurt myself with is gone. I'm not sure what they thought I was going to do with my pastry brush, but that's gone too. They've been ordering out every night because Mom can't be on her feet for long. Pizza, Thai, Italian. It's not bad, but I liked making my own food. I liked picking out ingredients. It made me happy. I get why I can't. I understand. I just wish there was something else I could do. I feel useless, which is why I snapped at Paul. "Don't be surprised. It's insulting to both of us. I'm not one of those brave people who suffer in silence. When I'm miserable, everybody knows it. I make sure of that." He was trying to explain why I couldn't make dinner, and I think I was telling him that the food he'd given me was poisoned. He asked me why I thought he would do such a thing. "Because you're not my father. Your kid will be normal and perfect, and nothing will be wrong with him. Why the hell would you want someone like me in the picture? I'd poison me too." Yelling at Paul made me realize that I was a douchebag for a number of reasons. The first one being that I still had not responded to any of Maya's messages since her hospital visit. My mom has so far respected my wishes and told her that I don't want to see anyone. But I knew what I needed to do. And even though emailing it to her was pretty chicken shit, it was the best I could do given the circumstances. "Dear Maya, I'm sorry. There's nothing I can say to make this better, but I wanted to tell you anyway. I never wanted you to know because I didn't want you to be afraid. It was selfish, but I couldn't stand the thought of you acting differently, being careful. Especially since I was the one who should have been careful. It was wrong to fall in love with you, and I should have known that from the beginning. No drug was ever going to fix me. I shouldn't have kept anything from you. You deserve better, and I really hope you get it. I love you. Adam." It was the first time I'd ever told her that I loved her. I am such a jerk.
When I hit send, I pretended I was writing to someone I'd never met before. It almost worked for a while. I sat down on the floor of my bedroom next to Rebecca and Rupert and Basil and a few familiar hallucinations that don't have names. Jason leaned against my closet door, and the mob boss sat in my desk chair, staring at me intently, because he'd never sit on the floor. I wanted to tell them that they weren't real. I wanted to shout at them and blame them for my losing Maya, but I was just too tired. "Hey, Rue," I said.
"Yeah, mate?"
he asked, leaning in.
"Can you guys sing to me?"
My voices had left, and I wasn't sure when they'd be back. I wasn't even sure if Rupert and Basil would take requests or if they could sing anything other than Danny Boy. I don't know much about the personal lives of my pretend people, but I asked because it was what I wanted, and I thought, what the hell? I was just going to feel all of it, everything I could reach. So I hummed along while Rupert sang a song called The Parting Glass, something I heard in an old movie once. Basil whistled. Rebecca held my hand. And for the first time, the mob boss didn't try to shoot anything. Chapter 39. June 5, 2013. Sure. I feel fine. My mom is still making me write to you even though our in-person sessions are over. I thought insomnia was the worst thing about the miracle drug, but I would gladly take insomnia over the walking dead shit they gave me. I was so tired, I didn't even register that Maya had marched into our house until she was standing right in front of me. She looked different from how I remembered. There was something slightly off about her. Like she could burst into flames at any moment. But that might have been the drugs. Paul and my mom came running when she started shouting. Well, Paul came running. My mom sort of waddled down the hallway, holding her belly with both hands. I'd never actually seen Maya this angry before. If it hadn't been so terrifying, it would have been beautiful.
"You didn't let me choose," she said.
I didn't say anything because I was sure she wasn't real. Paul was the one who asked her what she was doing. She just put her hand up, demanding silence, and Paul obeyed. It was hard not to be impressed by that. Then she turned back to me and repeated herself.
"You didn't let me choose."
"Choose what?"
"You just assumed that you knew what I wanted."
"Maya, it's not that simple."
"It doesn't matter."
"How could it not matter?"
"Adam, you are the biggest asshole I've ever met in my life," she shouted.
"I know." That stopped her for a second. I could tell she was really looking for a fight, but I had no reason to argue with her. And to be honest, hearing her swear was more shocking than hearing her yell.
"You lied to me."
"I'm sorry," I said.
"Don't be sorry. Just don't do the thing you have to be sorry for."
"Well, that doesn't..."
"I am still talking."
She looked a little possessed. Out of the corner of my eye, I could see my mom easing herself into a chair at the kitchen table, while Paul leaned against the fridge. I had been counting on them to lead Maya out of the house with my apologies, but it looked like they were going to make me handle this myself. Privacy was out of the question.
"Why didn't you tell me?"
I think at this point I pathetically looked at my mother, who shook her head and then looked at the floor. "You're on your own."
"Come on, Maya. You know why. I told you why." "I deserve better than a lame excuse and an email, Adam. Tell me." "I can't explain it."
That was a lie, but I didn't want to be honest.
"Try," she said.
Her lips were a straight line across her face. So I tried.
You know about the experimental drug I was on? The one my mom told you about. She nodded.